I'm still here. Hopefully everyone else is. If you have any questions on this COVID-19 and someone isn't doing tricks in the back, the bottom line is...
So annoying.
Okay, once again, any questions? Again, any questions on this subject? I wish it was as easy to just throw a carry on a...
Or you want me to pick it up, WS2N.
I don't know. I don't want to give this charming gentleman the benefit of having accomplished anything.
No problem. We can go back to you later. I'm standing by. Happy Easter, everybody. This is WS2N. Standing by.
Okay, well, I guess I'll just turn it over to you, Paul, do the space report, and we'll see what the future brings. And to everyone, once again, if you need to contact me for any topic, questions, mailbag, and otherwise, it's mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com, and the articles that I've mentioned will be available on the link page, roy.ac2gs.com, and the archives will be available at MikeKC2NJ's website, amateurradio.tv. I want to thank everyone who participated, and wish something terrible happens to the guy who's making noise in the background. And wish everyone a good Passover and a good Easter. So this is AC2GS, and I will turn it over to Paul.
Very good. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. There's half a dozen topics going on, even though the virus is trying to draw all businesses to a stop. Looks like in the space program, they consider a lot of the jobs essential, especially with military projects that have to go on, satellites for the military, GPS satellites, that type of thing. Will be continued to be built in. You know, but it's strange, you know, they're actually trying to keep it far away from one another, but yet when they're in these rooms, these clean rooms, they're all in complete bunny suits. I mean, these guys are all covered up. They don't want any kind of contamination getting onto the circuits or the instruments, whatever they might be doing. So, I mean, it's like they're set up for it anyway, for the type of environment. This is WS. Anyway, it was a launch on the 9th, just this past Thursday, of a Soyuz rocket up to the International Space Station. Very successful. They used a new Soyuz rocket with more digital equipment on board. Russians have been looking to change for decades. You know, a lot of this stuff has been analog, and now it's finally changed, which enables them to do things a little bit differently. They can easily get up to the space station quicker instead of a 32 orbit or a 2-day flight. They can do it now in 6 hours and dock with the station, space station. One of the advantages of this digital setup is they can roll when they launch, you know, all of our rockets when they launch, they can have the capability of rolling. When they roll, they're able to change their, you know, their inclination of where they're going to be going. Russians couldn't do that. Not with their rocket anyway, so they would pre-plan it, and they would turn the whole launch pad itself, massive, countless tons of steel. They would actually rotate the launch pad itself, stop it wherever they needed it, you know, wherever their inclination was going to be. So that was eliminated with this new Soyuz rocket. Anyway, they made it up to the space station. There were two Russians, Anatoly Ivanish, Ivan Wagner, and an American astronaut, Chris Cassidy, who's been up there before, and now he's returning. Chris Cassidy made a statement about the COVID virus being quarantined. They all could quarantine for about 2 weeks anyway. And in this case, it was about a month. But the only difference is that all the technicians and people that he works with are quarantined with him. So this way, they won't be bringing the virus to outer space. When they get up there and contaminate the other three that are on board, and the other three are Jessica Meir, an American, as well as Andrew Morgan, also an American. And Oleg Kipokrat, I can't read that problem with his name. Kika Pokeya is the other Russian up there. And they'll be eventually coming down this month, actually next week, on the 17th. They're scheduled to come down. So you can imagine these Americans, Jessica Meir and Andrew Morgan. When they were launched up there 6 months ago, there's no such thing as the COVID-19 virus. But now there is, and they spent 6 months more or less in quarantine away from the Earth. When they land in Kazakhstan on the 17th, in the fields, it's like a desert out there. It's up and down with their one big parachute land, and they would have medical teams come out and everything, which they normally have masks on when they first approach them anyway. Now they're going to be staying like that, and they won't be able to meet with their families. You know, usually the families are there sometimes to greet them when they get back to the base before they fly off, or even when they do fly off and they go to Houston, back to Houston. Jessica Meir and Morgan won't be able to, hug their family or anything. They'll be completely quarantined. So that's got to really be strange. I guess the only creatures we'll get the hug will be their dogs. You know, this is a very different world, including folks of the people on the space station and the people that are going up to the space station. They have a Progress cargo ship going up to the space station in a couple of weeks as well. And all that stuff has to be sterilized and everything. You know, once the virus gets up there and starts contaminating the crew, it's over. I don't know what contingency plans they have for a virus on board the space station, but it's going to be good. If there was a major problem, they can evacuate the space station and leave it run by itself for some amount of time, a couple of months or so. Never been done. The station started to be built in 1998. The first crews really on board in 2001. It's been continually manned all these years. So anyway, there's six people on board the space station, and they look happy when I saw their picture. They would take a group picture in the Zvezda module, the Russian module, when they first got up there.
Question, KC-1FAM.
Hi, Sam. KC-1FAM. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, kind of a request. Any chance you can go in through Sylvan? You're really noisy going in too loud.
Any better, Sam? I made a little change here.
Definitely better. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the info. You know, the repeat has been a little scratchy, but a good part of the night. So I moved my antenna around a little bit before, and now I moved it again. So hopefully that's better. So, okay, any other questions before I move on? Okay, the Starliner spacecraft being built by Boeing. We covered this quite a bit about 3 months ago when it first launched. The last like 7 years, Boeing has been building spacecraft that could carry actually 7 people, with plans to just bring 4 people up to the space station at a time. And they've been more or less competing with SpaceX. SpaceX has been building the Dragon, which could carry a crew of 4. Well, to the space station. And it looks like the Dragon is going to win out, but in the process of doing this work, Boeing launched an unmanned Starliner vehicle up to what was going to dock with the space station about 3 months ago. And it went off beautifully in Florida, launched on an Atlas V rocket with a new type of second stage. It's got two Centaur, rocket engines on board, instead of one. Atlas has always had one. Now it's got two for a crew vehicle, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. But it got to orbit, and then things went wrong. They had coding problems, timing problems, the internal clocks didn't match the external clocks on the booster, and one thing went wrong after the other. Rocket engine started firing, and started with in a different location on Earth, but the timer that was off. And eventually they more or less got low on fuel. NASA decided to bring the vehicle back, successfully landed, and this one lands on land, came down in New Mexico. It's got airbags, everything worked fine. So going up and going down, everything was very good, but because they ran out of fuel because the coding error. They never succeeded in bringing the vehicle all the way to the space station, have it dock by itself, and then undock and then leave. So, it was going to stay there a couple of days. The crew was going to go inside, the crew that's on station now. So, since that never happened, NASA was trying to push for, everything more or less worked, so let's put a crew on it next time. I'm sure that'll be fine. What could go wrong? So Boeing decided, they'll pay the extra, almost a couple hundred, I think it's a couple hundred million dollars, around $300 million or so, to launch another one of the Starliner vehicles. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to launch another one to the space station. And this time they think they're going to get it right. They will dock to the space station. They'll open the door. Crew will be able to go inside. show to take plenty of pictures, just like what they did with Dragon a year and probably you know, 2 months ago. Dragon did the same kind of test they docked with the space station. And then they'll stay a couple of days and they'll undock the space station, from the space station and come back and land in New Mexico again. Once they do that, NASA will certify and say, okay, the next flight is what I'm going for. Okay, before I go on, any other questions? And Sam, since you gave me the report before, that's the transmission last couple of minutes. Casey 1 at the WS1.
Yes, you know, it's noisy here. Pretty noisy. He came back.
Yeah, okay. My power. Let's see. Yep, well. I think something's up with the repeater. All the wind we've had lately caused the cracklies. That's probably what it is. Okay, let's see. Go over to the helicopter on Mars story. I know I've talked about this before, but there's a helicopter that's being built to travel with the rover, the 2020 rover, now called Perseverance, and its goal is to land the whole setup on Mars. And, you know, once the wheels open up, this rover is mounted underneath the belly of the rover. And the rover only weighs around 5 pounds, but the blades are 4 feet long, you know. It's two sets of blades, and they're 4 feet long. And everything just tucks in underneath the rover, so now as it comes down from the sky crane, has got these 8 rockets it's going to be firing, and the rover's wheels will open up, and then land on the surface. That gives you some space underneath for the helicopter. After they check everything out, eventually what they're going to do is drop off the helicopter and then ride away. And when they're about, they said they're going to be about 300 meters away, you know, like 1,500 feet or so. Eventually, days later, maybe 5-6 days later, the helicopter will take off for a flight and come back and land, take pictures when it's up there. And if that's successful, they'll do it again and again and again. You know, they got plans for at least five times to do this. So it has a solar panel on top of the spinning blades. So, you know, anytime it comes back down and lands, it'll just recharge and eventually take off again. That's going to be pretty cool if this all works. Let me drop it for any comments or questions. Okay, another company I cover quite a bit on, and that is Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab makes the Electron rocket. Electron rocket is, this rocket was built by, the owner is Peter Beck. One of these billionaires. He comes out of New Zealand, but he's got this Rocket Lab listed as an American company. They manufacture their engines, their Rutherford engines in California. And it's got 9 engines. All these rocket engines have turbos and pumps. Well, to run the turbos, usually they have the exhaust from a rocket running these things. So I have to have a pre-burner or something like that. You know, so you have gas, really rocket and energy spinning the turbine, spin the pump to push the thousands of gallons of fuel and oxygen, liquid oxygen, into the engines. But Rock and Lob chose to do away with all that. And what they have is electric motors, 50 horsepower motors that spin these pumps to do the same thing that turbines do on most rockets. And he's got lithium ion batteries in there. And flying like this, actually, he's got 11 flights so far from New Zealand. He's got his launch complex in New Zealand. And he's successfully launched 10 or 11 different satellites, some for NASA, some for independent companies. A lot of them are from colleges. And he really drove the price down. And to drive the price down a little bit more, he's going to try to make these things reusable. That was not the original plan when he first started, but he feels that with all the rocket launches he's got on his manifest, he won't be able to manufacture these rockets fast enough. So it will drive the cost down, but his main goal is, because he needs these rockets, you know, to launch right away again. So his goal is to make it reusable. Now, Elon Musk has set up this proven around 50 different times. He's done it so far. He'll pick a booster, he'll launch it, and he'll bring the booster back and land on land. He'll land on an autonomous drone ship out of the sea, you know, as big as a football field. Comes down vertically, and they come back to land on the ship. And what Peter Beck is doing with his Electron rocket from Rocket Lab is to launch the rocket from, in this case, New Zealand, and then after the FAA separates from the second stage, the first stage is going to come back down through the atmosphere, and he's going to have a parachute come out, and eventually a helicopter is going to come by with a hook to grab this thing from, you know, out of the atmosphere, and then once the helicopter has it, he's going to land. He's going to bring the booster onto a ship that's out at sea. So I saw a video of what he planned on doing, and it looked good if you could do it. So he ran a test about a week and a half ago before the COVID virus really took hold in New Zealand. So they were still up and running. They flew two helicopters, and they had a booster dangling on the bottom of it. They wanted to test to see if they could catch this thing. And one of the helicopters dropped the first stage. The other helicopter came along, eventually caught it with a hook. And they weren't far from land, and the helicopter brought it back and slowly put it back down on land. So it was pretty incredible to see that he had a video on that. So it's another example of these space companies able to bring the cost down and not litter all over the place. I mean, that's really what they usually do. I mean, these engines are at the bottom of the sea with countless boosters. And it'll be good to see them stop doing that in the future. Anyway, let me drop it and see if anybody has any comments. This is WS2N. Now, we're not the only one launching rockets. New Zealand, of course. I talked about that company. But China is coming back, and they're starting to launch rockets again. And you see the boy with the mask and everything as well. And they successfully launched one rocket, the Long March 3B rocket off the launch pad. And it got to the point where they separated with the second stage. And second stage was supposed to put this Indonesian satellite into geosynchronous orbit, you know, 23,000 miles above the Earth. Lo and behold, it all came apart. They had pictures from Guam. People were looking up and they took pictures of, video pictures of this debris that was flying through the air. So this is China's second failure in 1 month. They had one a couple weeks ago. So that's not good, too good. And some people I was reading about said that maybe the places are manned properly, maybe that, you know, they're not up to par with, having the these boosters take off properly with the, they're not manned. You just don't have the capability to do what you normally do. I don't know if that's the case or not, or just, bad luck. I mean, they have had many failures. They're trying to launch like 40 rockets this year. They keep going the way they're going. They're going to have problems. There's a lot of big flights that they plan on doing. They plan on putting another space station up into orbit. They plan on launching another rocket to the moon. It's going to bring in material back. For example, a return mission. They have another rocket that's planned on going to Mars with not only an orbit on board, but also a lander and a rover. They're supposed to be launching that this summer. So I'm not sure what's going on with China lately, but they've been going full blast the last 20, 30 years, and all of a sudden they're starting to have problems. Any comments or questions? Dragon cargo vehicle has been going up to the International Space Station since, 2010 now, so for 10 years. In those 10 years, they've launched about 20 of these cargo vehicles on Falcon 9 rockets, and they've docked with the International Space Station, and every time they do it, they take off 4,000 pounds of material and science experiments and food and stuff in the air for the crews that are on board. So they originally had a contract for 8 flights to the space station, and then they got another contract for 12 more. Or it might have been 12 and then 8, whatever it was, and then nevertheless, they've gotten up to their 20-year flights. They've got paid billions, many billions of dollars, I think around probably about $5, $6 billion from NASA or something, collectively, the two contracts. So now this last vehicle that went up, it was like the third time it went up. They've been reusing the cargo vehicles. They have these big solar panels that come out. They are now switching to a new new cargo vehicle for the next flight, number 21. And it's a similar design to the crew vehicle that's being built. So it's a little elongated trunk type of setup, truncated type of vehicle, a little longer. Carry more weight. Looks like a crew vehicle. The only difference is the crew vehicle has, well, of course, have capability to keep the crew alive for a couple of weeks at a time, where the cargo vehicle does have air and life support, but that's really for only after a dock, for the crew to. Got to go inside and take out all the stuff that they sent up, cargo. What it doesn't have, compared to the crew, is the Super Draco engine. not the inside, but, you know, on the side of the vehicle. The Pedrego engines are used for support situations. So let's say a crew was going up and they were sitting on launch pad and the booster decides to blow up. The Super Pedrego engines will pull them away in case of emergency. And they're good sized engines, there's 8 of them. And then they take up a lot of room and fuel those engines.
Internet web. design he's going to be putting up web to cover the whole Earth. You know, it's interesting. One day, the satellite train that's called flew over Alliance, Nebraska, and it was right after sunset. So the satellites were actually catching the sunlight. So they were completely visible, even though it was dark on Earth. And there's about 60 of them flew over. And people, the police headquarters has got overloaded. The sheriff's department got overloaded with phone calls. People freaked out when they looked up and saw the satellite train flying over. I heard the nurses were changing shift at the hospital, and we were still in, I think, daylight savings time, and it was 7 o'clock at night. I remember exactly 7:15, and it was dark, and they ran, they looked up and screamed, and the nurses, like, about half of them ran back into the hospital, knowing what this was flying overhead, you know? And it's such a formation. But at the right time, you're able to see Starlink satellite train fly over Alliance, Nebraska. Just wanted to add that comment. Back to Net Control.
Yeah, thanks for that, Ken. And yeah, maybe they can go out in a couple more days. There's another group going up April 16th. Now, supposedly, they're starting to paint them a little darker. They want to put a sunshade on these things eventually, but there is a problem with the astronomers are going nuts. You know, what are we doing with, you know, now he's got now 360 satellites up there. Each time he does a launch, he launches 60 more satellites. Each satellite weighs 500 pounds. So, you know, it's like a 30,000 pound launch every time he does it. And each one has ion engine on it, so they're able to push themselves further and further away, higher in orbit. They start off lower in orbit, up, you know, maybe I think 180 miles up, and they work their way up to around 300 miles, I think, 300 miles above the Earth. And he has plans for the broadband service with the Starlink satellites to put up like 1,200 of them, minimum 1,200, and then he could eventually start selling subscriptions to Starlink. Now that's only the beginning. He wants worldwide, communication. To do that, he's got plans on putting, you know, not 1,200, but like 12,000 satellites. And then eventually they're going to, you know, some are going to fail, and then he wants to replace them. He's put in requests for up to 40,000 satellites. So, I mean, this is really nuts. Let me drop it. So, hopefully he's able to, you know, do a sunshade or darken them or do something. But that must have been some site. You're out in the middle of nowhere where you probably don't have any light pollution. You probably know, of course, you can see the International Space Station. You can get their app, and they'll tell you when it's going over. So in either the dawn or at night, dusk, you can see the International Space Station go up. Sometimes it's, negative 3 on the magnitude level, you know, which is really bright. You can see it all the way down to like minus 1. It's the same idea what you saw out there. You get the dusk, and the sun is hitting the satellites, even though it's dark on Earth at that time, and you can see them quite clearly. So that must have been pretty good, Ken. Thanks for that.
Hey, you're welcome. It's always nice to share a story. That's what the radio's for, isn't it? And, I'm out here. It's very, very dark. It doesn't get any darker, you know? But I live in a city, but it's a small city. And even with that, I live in the center of the town. And even with the light pollution, I was able to see them, you know? But, you know, our light pollution is nothing compared to some other places. But, okay, I'm going to let it go back to you, and I'm going to keep driving down the road here. And happy Easter to everybody that's listening, and yourself. And I'll say 70 degrees from western Nebraska. This is November 2. By the way, we only have one person in the county that has COVID-19. They just self-quarantined for 14 days, but it was just announced to the local population today that they had somebody, but they've been in their, they live in a ranch anyway, away from everybody. So they're pretty much over it, but they did have one person in the entire county. So we're waiting for this, they call it a surge. The governor of Nebraska called it the surge, but we're waiting for the wave. The wave is predicted to hit out this way in about 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, end of the month. So everybody's bracing for this wave. You know, like when you go to Jones Beach and the water's really cold and you first go in and you wait for that wave to hit you in the chest, you know? That's a cool. You're only in waist-deep water, but you wait for that wave, and then you always seem to jump up when it comes, you know, because you don't want it to go in your mouth. So we're waiting for that wave like you do at Jones Beach to hit us. Okay, 70 degrees from western Nebraska. Bye-bye.
Okay, and stay safe out there, Ken. I mean, you know, if the past is any prediction of the future, it doesn't look good even for the rural areas, you know. You're probably better off, you're spread out, but, you know, testing is important. They should, you know, in my opinion, test all 350 million of us, every one of us, you know. Along with the antibody test, you know, I want to find out if I had it, you know. I didn't feel too good about it a couple of weeks ago. Maybe I had it, and maybe I'm immune. I'll never know. They've got to get funding, in my opinion, on a national level, not a state level or county level. It's a worldwide problem. Be safe. Everybody on back in New York here they're all wearing masks. So I highly recommend that. You don't want to get this. Okay, back to the SpaceNet report. Unless somebody has a comment. Okay, this is a spacecraft called OSIRIS-REx, and OSIRIS-REx. Was launched around 3.5 years ago on an Atlas V rocket. It had one booster, and they sent it out to an asteroid called Bennu, B-E-N-N-U. It's been orbiting this asteroid. It's got like a squarish look to it. It's not a round looking thing. So it's got an unusual gravitational feel to it. So they spent a lot of time perfecting that gravity, that orbit around this thing. The ultimate goal is to bring samples back to Earth. And they've got this robotic arm on the end of it. It goes out about 8 feet. And they have something called the tag unit on the end, touch and go. So they're going to eventually go down to the asteroid. It looks like a plate on the end of the arm, probably about a foot diameter, a little bit less. And as it touches the asteroid, it's going to push nitrogen gas through some of the force, and then any debris that's on the asteroid will get forced off the asteroid, and it'll get sucked into this same unit, this round setup. Once they do that, they hope to get anything from a couple of ounces to maybe a couple of pounds, kilogram or something, and then they'll put it into return, looks like a little flying saucer, a little setup with
heat shield on it. And then 3 years from now, it'll come back actually to the Utah desert. That's where they plan on bringing you back. And it'll separate from the OSIRIS-REx mothership, and this lander will come down and with parachute and all and land in Utah. But if scientists could get a hold of it, but the reason I'm talking about it now is this week they plan on practicing and getting closer and closer right now to miles or so. They want to go in close to like the 200 mile area and eventually down to the 100 mile area. Maybe even closer than that. And they're going to experiment with the robotic arm, you know, opening and closing that. And once they do that, another month or so from now, they're going to do the exact same thing except going closer, to, you know, maybe a couple of miles above the surface.
KD2AXJ.
Yeah, go right ahead.
Thank you. Everything you're talking about is very interesting. Question, I got three, okay? My name is Sam here. I'm in Baldwin. Number one, how large are the satellites? Number two, how do they get them up into space? And number three, you said they're going to have so many. What does each one do, and how do they drive them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Starlink satellites. Well, there's each one weighs 500 pounds. There's 60 every time they shoot them up there. Planned on, originally before the virus thing hit, he wanted to have 24 launches this year alone. That was his goal. I know he's not going to make that, but that was his goal. Each time, 60 more satellites. So each one runs. They have ion engines to push it around to get it to where it belongs, you know, after they all start to separate. They're going to be able to talk to each other. I think some of them are going to have laser links, laser communication, but nevertheless, they'll talk to one another. So you'll be able to talk to one satellite, and that will talk to all the other satellites. And, you know, you want to talk to Europe, and they'll link all the way to Europe. And then for a ground base, you're going to need a 18-inch looks to me it's probably a dish, but it looks like a little flying saucer, so they probably have a cover on top. You know, my guess is probably a plexiglass type of fiberglass on top to protect it from the elements. You know, that's your whole setup. And who knows what they're going to be charging for this. And eventually you'll be able to get even TV, communications, and relatively low, like in 300 mile area, maybe 400 mile area up, you're gonna have low latency, so you won't have a lag on your computer. Eventually, when they start to fail, they'll be replaced. But because they have the ion engines on board, they can actually lower their orbit and deorbit within a matter of weeks instead of staying up there for years on end. Another company recently was trying to do the same thing called OneWeb. OneWeb contracted with Russia to launch satellites. So they launched, I think, three. Each one had like 30 satellites on board. So they got up to like 70 satellites. The last 30, which was only like a month ago, a month or two ago, the last 30 that OneWeb sent up there, they knew they were going broke. I can't believe anybody would let them launch this thing. Right after they launched it, they went broke. So now you got 70 satellites doing nothing, clogging up the space at a much higher altitude, maybe 600 or 700 miles high, instead of a lower altitude that Elon Musk is putting his Starlink satellites at. So now these things are going to take, I don't know, I think they said years to eventually deorbit. So that was kind of silly. So that's about it. I might have missed a question or two, but back to you, Sam. KD2KXJWS2M.
Thank you so much. I got a better picture of it. So they load them all up into one ship, right? And one ship leaves from here up to space, and then they unload them, like disconnect them. But who operates each one of them? Do we have people down here that operate each one, or they just float on their own?
Yeah, they're all controlled from Hawthorne, California. That's where SpaceX is headquartered. So, that's their job to make sure these satellites are where they're supposed to be as they go up. And if you see them, they're all lined up, you know, like a bunch of cards in a deck, and except each one is 500 pounds. The fairings open up, when the rocket goes up, the top nine goes up, the booster separates, the booster comes back, lands on a ship, they can reuse the booster. That thing's like 160 feet tall, 12 feet diameter, 9 engines on it. The second stage has one engine on it, one Merlin engine, and that pushes the satellites to the proper orbit, and that separates. It separates from the payloads. The fairings opened up, the fairings flew away, and now he's trying to save the fairings. He actually catches them with the ship down below. Each ship has a net on it as big as a football field, and he actually has done it a couple of times. Catches the fairings and then reuses those fairings. Fairings cost around $6 million, though. But nevertheless, the satellites are all grouped together, and they get released, and there's nothing actually holding them together. It's just form fitting, one into the other. So when they separate, there's no springs or anything. It just kind of separates, and they start to float apart. And eventually, as they get further and further apart, Hawthorne, California, their mission control at SpaceX is able to, turn these satellites on. They have the ability to detect where they are in space, their attitude. They have inertia control type of setup, little motors that spin these momentum wheels inside this. You could pitch it, you could roll it, you could yaw it, and get it to where you want it, and then you could actually light off the ion engine and move it further away, that type of thing. So, that's it. Let me drop it. Surprised I couldn't time it out. Okay, and that's pretty much it. Anything else, Sam, or we'll continue on? I guess we're getting up to 11 o'clock anyway, so I'm going to come probably to a grinding halt anyway. The rest of the material, I can talk about this next week, I guess. Any other comments or questions? This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report on the TechNet.
This is N2RQ.
Hi, N2RQ. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Paul. I'm going a little bit far afield here, but I'm pretty sure you were listening into the Limewalk meeting last week, and I had a related project monitoring some component of space weather using that 24 kilohertz signal. Did you happen to see my email, and you think there might be any interest?
That tonight at 8 o'clock, this.
I missed your email.
Complete.
No, I didn't see that. If you sent it, I didn't see it. I'd like to see that. I got on the, you're talking about the general meeting? Yeah, I was on that. That was great. That was just great. That's what we're talking about. The video set up that the club ran.
That antenna system, I learned a lot about it, but I had already known about it. There's a project known as Super SID, that's SID, and it uses the signal from these, or a number of the signals from these very low frequency transmitters to monitor the condition of the ionosphere, and that's an indication of solar activity. Over.
Oh yeah. Well, that was the presentation that they had there was with those big antennas. I mean, thousands of acres of antennas for submarine communication. I was fascinated with that. Listen to the call letter. The guy that gave that presentation was from Radio Central. It just fascinated. But yeah, you're talking about the monitoring the ionosphere. Now they have two space probes that are involved doing that as well. One gold, they call it. Gold is located in geosynchronous orbit, and another one that was launched by a Pegasus rocket, ICOM, that's at a low atmosphere level. Yeah, maybe 500 miles up or something. So you got one of the geosynchronous in that one. Along with what you're talking about, you can get a good idea of what's going on in the ionosphere. You know, or both satellites I'm talking about are really specific for ionosphere weather, essentially. That's great. Back to you, Lou.
Okay, we found we didn't get to do very much with it at the school, but it is a relatively inexpensive project, and there are stations monitoring using that package around the world. So if anybody's interested, maybe we get some more ground stations here setting them up. Anyway, that's all I had tonight, Paul. The message I sent out, I sent to the Limewalk I.O. group.
Oh, okay. Yeah, now I know why. I got to sign up for the reflector, I guess. All right, very good. Thanks, Lou. And let's see if anybody had any last comments. It's after 11. We usually should start the shutdown, but we don't necessarily have to. Any comments? If not, we're going to turn it back to Roy.
Thanks, Paul, for a good show, KD2FIU.
Thank you very much, George. And we'll be back next week. And tomorrow, of course, is the Club InfoNet on all these great repeaters that we're on. Over to you, Roy, AC2GS, WS2N. If you want to do something else, too, that you had something that you wanted to continue on, it's what, 11 o'clock, 5 after 11, I guess. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. It's past 11. We reset the clock on this. To end around 11 o'clock, and We'll be back next week to do it all over again. No doubt there'll be lots of stories. We'll once again